Secretary will close the roll. Being there's 37 ayes and 28 nays, the bill as amended by the conference committee was repassed and its title agreed to. Members, we're on a roll.
Mr. President,
I just figured it out.
Mr. President, a point of inquiry, please.
Members,
Mr. President?
Members, we are moving forward, and we're
Mr.
on
President,
a roll, as
a point
I haven't
of,
figured out, members.
Mr. President, a point of parliamentary inquiry.
We will be here until 8 o'clock tonight based on the next four bills that we're looking at hearing.
I understand, Mr. President. Mr. President, a point of parliamentary inquiry, if I might, for a second.
Senator
Mr. President,
Cohen.
I was standing to be recognized to make a very brief response to something Senator Michelle said. You looked in my direction. I normally don't speak after the author of a major bill like this speaks. I wanted to make about a 60-second response to Sarah Michelle. And I'm curious to know why the President looked in my direction, as well as Senator Marty's direction, and refused to recognize us for a brief response. Exactly why was that, Mr. President? I've been a member of this place for quite a while. I don't recall being cut off from debate or having the minority cut off from debate when we were in the majority, as has been the case here. So I'm curious, Mr.
Members.
President. Mr. President, as a matter of inquiry, I'd like to know what the rules are.
Senator Cohen, when I called on Senator Ortman, you just sat down. I called for the secretary to take the roll. I did not see you stand up. Secretary, under messages from the House,
point of order.
Move forward. We have House
Mr.
File
President, point of order.
Secretary.
Mr. President, point of order takes precedence.
Senator Latz.
Mr. President, our rules provide that Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure controls the floor debates here, except when our specific Senate rules say something different. Mason's Chapter 10, Section 90, the right to debate questions, Paragraph 1, debate is the essential feature of a legislative body. Paragraph 2, it is the fundamental rule of parliamentary practice governing all deliberative assemblies that the opportunity to deliberate and, if possible, convince their fellows is the right of the minority, which right they cannot be deprived of by the arbitrary will of the majority. Mr. President, you even recognize that Senator Cohen wished to speak when you turned and granted the floor to Senator Ortman, who you had on your list first. Mr. President, you arbitrarily denied Senator Cohen and knowingly Senator Marty of their right to speak on these matters.
Senator Latz, it is the discretion of the chair to recognize a member. And in this case, I did not see Senator Cohen stand after I called roll. And once I called roll and the secretary took it, we can't move forward on that. So if it's a slight mistake because I didn't see Senator Cohen, I'll accept that and I will continue to do better as we move forward. Secretary, under messages of the House.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce that the House has adopted the recommendation and report of the Conference Committee in House File Number 934 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. House File 934, Bill for an Act Relating to Education. House File 934 is herewith transmitted to the Senate. Albin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
Senator Olson.
Mr. President.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report for House File 934 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
On that motion, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know it's past midnight and I haven't turned into a pumpkin, but I'm on the way to being a vegetable, and so I will add this disclaimer that if I do get my tongue tangled around my eye teeth, it's because I'm tired. So it seems a bit of a sorry state that we are at this hour taking up a bill that represents 41% of the state budget. But it needs to happen, and so I will try to give you a brief overview of the conference committee report, some of the differences between the this report and how our bill left the Senate, and some of the accommodations that we were able to include as a result of having a meeting with the governor. And we'll take your questions. I believe a packet of information is being distributed that includes the staff summary of the bill, a spreadsheet, a couple of what we call runs, what someone has referred to as the scourge of Western civilization, the runs, because they are they never do have a clear picture of all of the factors that are going on in the education funding formula. It's complex, and it has grown that way over the years, even though efforts to simplify it have been attempted. As I indicated, this bill represents 41% of the state budget. $14.1 billion in state appropriations are made, and $4.4 billion in local school levies are authorized for the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium. It is by far the largest single component of our $34 billion general fund budget. And it's estimated that the state provides over 75% of the total state local revenue for school districts. I don't think there are too many states that exceed that. One I know for sure, and that's Hawaii, which has one school district. It is the state school district, and so they fund 100% of their schools. There may be one district out there. I don't have the figures before, but at 75%, we are one of the highest contributors to our public schools with state monies. When you compare to our previous biennium, the increase in state aid from 2010 and 11 to 12 and 13 is $465 million. And it does not include last year's one-time stimulus money. So technically, the state's investment between the last biennium and this biennium is in the neighborhood of $900 million. So the revenue available for education is not less, it is more. And that revenue will cover the growth. There is about a 2% growth in student population that's anticipated, and also expected additional needs in special education and additional students served. And there are other elements that are recognized in that additional expenditure. We have attempted. We were challenged, as I told you, I think, when we took up our Senate bill, that all across the country, people were facing and accepting the reality that we were living with flat revenue, and that our challenge was to continue to make progress in improving student achievement while we did not have a great deal of additional resources to put into education. And so therefore it's a challenge but also an opportunity to say, what are we getting for the money we are investing? And are there things that we might do that would help us to improve student achievement and close the achievement gap? We have invested in streams of revenue to help schools meet the challenge of the students they serve. And yet we have the highest achievement gap of any state in the nation. The only achievement gap that's higher is not a state, it's Washington, D.C. So we do have a challenge. And as you've seen from Peter Hutchinson's presentation in a number of committees working with the Itasca Project, our reading scores, reading proficiency scores, and NAEP scores have been absolutely flat at the same time that our revenue has essentially continued to increase. So it's obvious that just more spending is not the only answer. Now, it's tough to make changes, particularly in funding streams. As someone said to me, anytime you try to move a nickel around, there's going to be screaming. For those of you who grew up on a farm, you may remember what it was like to wean calves. You never got any sleep that night because the hollering that was going on would keep you awake all night because they weren't ready to make the adjustment to another source of their nourishment. So it happens. It happens. But we tried to do some cautious attempts to do some things that would actually recognize the efforts to close that achievement gap and improve student achievement with a small funding stream. And we did attempt to make some changes in the growth of others so that we could add some dollars to the formula that would benefit all of our school districts across the state. The bill, the conference report that's before you, doesn't have everything that we had in our Senate bill. We don't have $50 on the formula each year. We have $20 and $21. It's small, but it's a bit of a step. We did not freeze the growth or eliminate the growth factor for special education. Now, the growth factor for special education was there to try to help reduce the cross subsidy. The growth is not related to serving additional students with special ed with some different needs. That's been dealt with in the revenue that I've already addressed. So what the growth factor, well, we've restored part of it. The reality was that growth factor is consumed by the growth in teacher salaries, even when you have a soft freeze, where you have 4-6% that goes into the steps and lanes. So without the freeze, even leaving the growth factor in place, there would be no easing of the cross subsidy. We've gone halfway. That's one of the things we did to respond to the governor's concern. And that is part of what has lowered the amount available for the for increasing the formula. We did not freeze compensatory revenue. It has been delinked, however, along with the sparsity revenue. That means it's not on automatic pilot as the formula increases. It doesn't mean that might not change. Every legislature comes back and revisits the funding of education. And I think based on the reflected need and what the investment of those streams are doing in terms of what that legislature believes our needs, can make decisions to add as much or make alterations as any other legislature could. So it is, well, it's delinking. It is not freezing compensatory revenue or any of sparsity and other streams. The decision was made in both House and Senate to eliminate the integration revenue. Now, I know that's caused a fair amount of angst. The Senate bill did not alter that in the first year, allowing for some adjustment to a transition to a literacy incentive aid to reward not only achievement of proficiency at the third grade in reading, but also growth toward that end. So districts that are really having a tough time with the achievement gap, when they make growth, will be eligible for that aid as well. So that is innovative. I know that I doubt very much that there are funding formulas anywhere in the country that have moved to having at least a small stream recognize and reward achievement of a very key area that's foundational and fundamental to the achievement in the future and the future life of our students. That money also, some of that money also went to greatly expanding the Reading Corps, which has been proven to be a very effective support for helping young people over that hurdle. What we did do is to soften that difficulty, we left the levy in place. So 30% of the integration revenue is still in place. And as one other measure to soften it, part of what was the aid in the first year was taken and moved to the second year and continued as a transition aid into the future. One of the other, those were all accommodations that I think were of interest to the governor. The desegregation transportation had been, revenue had not been included in the Senate bill, but that is restored. So that some of the integration districts, some of the programs, the choice is yours, the fair school that I've heard that we know about that has been an effective choice for students can still continue. Those programs can continue. The aid follows them, as it does in open enrollment or in any other situation. And the transportation funds are available for them. As I mentioned, we've increased the appropriation for Reading Corps. That was a provision in the Senate that prevailed. Another addition, but there are a number things that were not in our bill, that were in the House bill, reforms that they pursued that are included. One of those is an opportunity scholarship that's available to low-income children from low-performing schools to take their money to attend a private school of their choice. It is only available in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth, so it is on a small scale. And the schools that do accept those scholarships must agree to administer the state tests in writing, reading, and math, so that there is some determination whether this choice is actually helping to improve their education. Teacher evaluation has been on the radar for some time, and there have been a variety of proposals out there. The House had a very prescriptive plan in place. The Senate did not include all of that proposal in theirs, allowing much more flexibility at the local level for developing an evaluation system, but establishing a basic framework for it. What is in the conference committee report is a bit of blending, removal of some of the prescriptive nature of it, but also providing some structure and some that may be more than what people would like, but that 50% of an evaluation should tie to student achievement and their performance, and whether it's on statewide tests, which will work in some subject areas, or locally administered tests, or other kind of criteria. There are several steps that would help local districts to accommodate this requirement in the evaluation of teachers of all of the subjects and things that they services that they render within the school system. The other 50% is totally based on local criteria. There are some options that are included within the legislation that give some more definition to that. And there's also a task force established to review and work toward any further efforts to improve or strengthen that approach. It is tied to the future of what happens with employment for layoffs and rehires, giving greater flexibility. Some of you may have been hearing from the people that what they call LIFO, L-I-F-O, last in, first out, that gives some flexibility to schools that if they've got a solid, high-performing teacher, that seniority and bargaining agreements won't get in the way of being able to keep that high-performing teacher. A House had a provision that was not considered in the Senate, and that was an A to F rating program for schools. We do have, and if you go to the Department of Education's website, you do have school report cards. It does not have a specific classification or designation by grade, but the data is there in evidence that would intermesh with such a rating. This was a provision that had proved effective in Florida, in that people understand A through F rather than other kinds of things, and it was highly coveted by the schools and advertised when they received a good rating, a good grade, and I think appreciated by the parents and families for the ease of identifying how their school is doing. It carries a reward, a financial reward as well. There are some limitations on the teacher's right to strike, because the qualified economic offer is there, and as long as a school board offers a percentage equal to the increased revenue that comes to them through the formula, for economic purposes, they cannot strike. There are some steps that follow that, and I think if there's questions on it, that was Senator Rosen's initiative, and she's here, and I hope we'll be able to answer any questions. If there's impasse on negotiations, they can be settled through binding arbitration, which is the final total offer package, and the decision that is made should not cause a structural budget deficit. The bill also repeals a number of state mandates that have made things difficult for school boards to give them some flexibility through times like this, but also recognizing that they can make the decisions locally and we don't have to be prescriptive in law. And we should put them to that test. Because we are increasing also evaluation. There's an administrative evaluation provision within the bill, the conference report, as well as principal evaluation. I feel strongly, and others do too, that if the principals and administrators are evaluating teachers, they should be evaluated, and one thing they should be able to demonstrate is that they can be effective evaluators and know how to work effectively with their staff so that this isn't a threatening or a gotcha kind of situation, but it's an opportunity for growth in the service that they are rendering in our school districts. But of the mandates, we have repealed the required staff development set aside of 2%, and the and the other staff development requirements. There is some restatement of that that gives a broader framework for staff development included with the teacher evaluation provisions. The Safe Schools maintenance of effort requirement for counselors and support personnel has also been removed. And many were concerned with the provision or the current requirement that requires a licensed community ed director for school districts that are over 2,000. And a request was made for a higher limit. That was not granted, but 7,500 residents is the ceiling that is proposed in this bill. The statewide integration rule has been eliminated as well, believing it's unnecessary given civil rights laws and court decisions. And segregation is not legal, period. And as I noted, there is transportation aid for those who feel that movement is important for it. I can defend the literacy incentive provision as a good tool for integration as well. We have people coming from all over the world to this country, and they come for freedom and the opportunity to succeed, to get ahead, and to pursue their dreams. And you can't do that very well if you can't communicate. And a common language is important. And with English as the international language of commerce, and no sign that that's going to change anytime soon, I think it's very important that we have a solid instruction in literacy for our newcomers as well as for our current residents. And I think that opens the door not only to communication and better understanding, but for those who are wanting to get ahead, it's an absolutely essential tool to getting the kind of education and pursuing the opportunities that will give them a good livelihood and open the doors to making both the economic choices, but the places to live. Many of our neighbors are getting more integrated, but they're getting that way because people are succeeding and able to make those choices. We shouldn't be trying to hold them back with low expectations. And so that I believe very strongly in. We have also set some limits that no new department rules in special education can be added. There's been some concern that we have a differential between state and federal regulations. We did not make any specific changes to any of that. I think it's important that all of the stakeholders be a part of making that kind of decision. But sometimes the department goes ahead with rules that add further complication to the administration and delivery of special education in our schools. And we've also restricted that academic standards and curriculum rules cannot be adopted unless there's specific legislative approval. We had some extensive discussion. As many of you know, that there's Common Core standards that are being developed through the National Governors Association. Maybe you don't know, because I was at a national conference and many of the leaders of legislators had never even heard of it. But it was initiated by the Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association. You'll notice there's one entity that's missing there, and that's legislatures. And this legislature has been active in wanting to assure solid standards that the basis for the curriculum and the instruction that goes on in our schools. And I think it's not without some wisdom that the legislature retain that oversight and the ability to examine and through legislation give that authority rather than it to just rest with the commissioner. There are there were a number of individual fund transfers. Those are not included, but there is a broader fund transfer permit generally, but it's only if there's no late aid or levy impact. This will allow the $51 for sure to continue of the capital, operating capital, into the general fund, so that that is not restricted and represent a lowering of revenue available to for operating the schools. And the fewer reporting requirements, both for homeschoolers, that has an impact not only on them but on the superintendents and school districts, that we've seen for 3 years and passed out of this floor this year again with all green votes, is included here. There's some miscellaneous provisions I'll just identify quickly, and we'll open for questions. We've established a minimum number of hours for student instruction to give some clarity rather than just days, which were not, they were within range of one another, but they weren't, there was not any uniformity there. I've mentioned the superintendent, the evaluation part. We had a limited amount, we were able to increase the career and technical levy a small amount. Some of the districts are struggling to keep some of their programs open. They recognize as a very important option for young people that learn best and have learning styles that that operate with better in a hands-on and an experiential kind of environment. And in many of the fields, in particular agriculture, we've also acknowledged that when they have instruction that matches standards in some of our academic areas, that the young people will get credit for that. The permanent school fund distribution has been open to all public school students, and that includes those in charter schools. That was a provision in the House bill that was adopted. And school districts will be allowed to use interactive technology to conduct meetings. A provision that was in our bill that 9th and 10th grade students be allowed to enroll in college in the schools if space is available is there. It doesn't necessarily carry, not likely to carry college credit because that is determined by the colleges. And trial placement at the Minnesota Academies for Deaf and Blind is permitted. Those are some of the highlights of what's in the bill, and I'd be happy to stand for questions if you have them, and others in the chamber may be able to respond as well.
Discussion on the motion, Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam President, and thank you, Senator Olson. It's kind of interesting. The shoe is on the other foot, and I appreciate all the work that you put into it. And I realize the difficulty that you had in the process. I believe anytime the House is a very formidable opponent in conference committees, and I think that we've found that out over the years. And I believe the conference committee. I guess if I could just characterize the package as one that's it had a lot of potential, and I really think that the end product could have been quite a bit better, but in a sense we just kind of, I think, ran short of time to refine some of the things that could have been done. But there are some problems that I want to just mention to members. And certainly point out a few things that make it difficult, I think, for many of us to get behind with full support. First of all, we're expecting, I think, a lot from our Department of Education, and I know that The governor's proposed cut is the cut, I believe, that the conference committee adopted, which was the 5% cut, and I believe that was about $990 some thousand. But we also have the same problem when we discussed the State Department's bill this afternoon, because it wasn't the only, the 5% cut is not the only cut that the department will be will have to shoulder. There's also the $95 million that will be assessed across the board. And in visiting with the commissioner, they're very, very worried about how they're going to be able to take that additional cut on when most of their employees, and I think it's a very high percentage of their employees at the department, are currently being funded with federal money. And that has been a result of over several years of squeezing the department down. So they have that additional $95 million across-the-board cut for all state agencies, and how much that translates for the Department of Education will remain to be seen, because the Department of Management and Budget will have to divvy out that to the different agencies. Then there's also the FTE reduction, which I believe in the State Department's bill they had talked about it being equivalent to about $61 million, but that has to be, there would be a subtraction of that 5% cut from that cut. So when all that shakes out, there is a real fear, I think, in the department when we want them to do more and to try to accommodate the provisions that are, some of the provisions that are in the bill. It's going to be very difficult for them to do. There, I think another one of the disappointments popped up in a couple of different ways. One, we had a little discussion on the floor a number of weeks ago, and that relates to the early childhood funding. And I think that's a real shortcoming in this bill. We have had discussions about how early childhood is one of the wisest and best investments that we can make in our education system. And we kind of let that opportunity slip through our hands. And I think that there's still opportunity for that to be part of it. The governor strongly supports initiatives and funding in early childhood. I think both the House and the Senate are interested in the early childhood, but as far as addressing it, we kind of neutered it by taking the funding out of it, and that's one area where I think we need to look to do some restoration. The other one that I think maybe Senator Therese Ray might talk about is, and this was a real concern which was partially addressed, and that is the cuts to special education. That's an area that has been a growing concern for many districts across the state, and one that I know Senator Olson, you're concerned about as well. But that is an area that I think will have to be addressed because of the enormous cost in the cross subsidies. There are some others that I'll just touch on. One is, I think, when I had several meetings with educators up in my area, and I mentioned this at a meeting that we had just, I think, a day or two ago with the number of department people as well as House and Senate education members, was the kind of the demoralized feeling that our educators have as a result of a number of factors. One being, I think, just the sheer number of labor changes, things that impact them, and their seem to create a negative feeling out there about how well they can do their job in teaching, as well as how well they're able to make a living at teaching. And I think that's one thing that got in the way of the education package that we have here before us. Somehow that has to be addressed. And I think one way to do it is to look at some of the policy initiatives. I think we were overwhelmed with a lot of changes in the area of things like labor issues, a whole host of things that were important to educators, such as staff development and how they are going to have to respond to the new initiatives that are in the bill. So that was a problem, and that's still in a problem, and I believe in this bill is the sheer number of things that are going to impact educators across the state. I know that the school districts and many administrators sought greater flexibility by getting rid of mandates, but there are mandates that have a real purpose. And one of them, we've been in discussions the last few days, is how poor we are doing in the area of having adequate counselors in our schools. I believe we're number 48 or 49th in the nation. And I think that's one area where I think we should have kept the money set aside for those safe school levies set aside. So members, those are just a few areas that I wish we could have had some additional time to develop. The one in particular was the assessment and evaluation of our educators. That is an issue that I think all sides or all parties had a willingness to come together on, and we had an example to follow, and that was really in that the principal's evaluation. We could have used that format, and we could have, I think, been able to pull our educators into that discussion fairly easily. And I think we still have time to do that. I think we can develop an assessment and evaluation, and that is something that would be a real accomplishment in this session. There's, I think, another initiative that Senator Olson has been very diligent and committed to, and I think is an essential part as we move forward, is in the whole area of literacy. And this is something that I think all the parties involved have really come together on, and I think that's a very important component of this bill. So I compliment you on that, and just wanted to make the point of that those points that I made. The one question I would leave and end this on would be, I was just wondering, Senator Olson, why the five conferees did not sign the conference committee.
Senator Olson.
Madam President, Senator Stumpf, I will let the ones that did not speak for themselves.
Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Stump, thank you actually for asking that question. For those of you that did not know, I was one of the conferees that did not sign. And being a teacher, this is something that is very near and dear to my heart. And I came to, one of the reasons why I came here is because I wanted to see some changes happen. I wanted to see some differences that were going to happen in the classroom. And we had 4 months of listening to all kinds of stuff in the Senate committees, and so there was a lot of time to process through stuff, and I was very happy with the bill that we passed out of here. When we got the House's language as well, I didn't have 4 months to digest that. And there was one part in particular which you brought up, which was the evaluations of teachers, that was kind of sticky for me. And I think it's a phenomenal idea. I love the idea of having teacher evaluations. And more importantly, teacher evaluations exist. What I like mostly is the fact that now teachers' evaluations will have some teeth. They need to have a purpose. Why evaluate? What is the point of being, and I've had this happen, what is the point of being evaluated as an exemplary teacher and then being let go in April? Well, because I was the last one in, so I'm the first one out. So the evaluation meant nothing. So I love the concept of having an evaluation that will mean we can evaluate a teacher and keep teachers that are effective. So I love that concept. And I was a little fuzzy with some of the language in how the House had that. And on Monday when we signed, I was still a little fuzzy. And because I care so much about what comes out of here, I was not ready to sign at that time. And in the meantime, I've done a lot of discussion with it. We've looked at it. I've seen different parts of it where I say, okay, my biggest concern was implementation. I think most people can say they love the concept, but my sticking point was the implementation. I have lived through outcome-based education, profiles of learning, No Child Left Behind. I've had these different things that have come through us one after another from the government telling us here's how we do it in our classroom. So I wanted to see, this evaluation's a great idea, but I wasn't quite sure how we were going to implement it yet. And I can say that I can see how we can implement it. And one of the flexibilities that I can see in it now, and you brought up the principal's evaluation, there is room for that, that a school district can choose to use that model if they want to. And there is enough flexibility, because my question was, well, how do we do this with the band teacher? I'm one of the subjects that I teach is PE. How do you rate me in PE? How does it work grade to grade, subject to subject, the teacher who teaches for a year, a year's course, the teacher who teaches a credit or a one-quarter course? So it had to be able to be implemented. And so after looking at it for a few more days and really digging into it, I believe it can be implemented. And that was my sticking point for why I didn't sign on Monday. I love what I see in here. I'm excited to see changes that can potentially happen in the classroom. I know the big sticking point is always money. And honestly, I don't think anything we do, there's never going to be enough money. No matter what we come up with, there's never going to be enough money. And you're never going to pay teachers what they're worth. You are never going to have an unlimited supply of money to do whatever we want to in the classroom. And so when I look at the big picture of this bill, I see change, and I'm excited about the stuff that's in here. But change is not always easy. And it's hard to get rid of programs sometimes because we've done them forever. And so sometimes we kind of have to take that leap and say, you know what, we haven't tried this. It's different. We're not real sure, but maybe this is finally what will make the achievement gap close. Maybe this is what will finally get kids reading by third grade. Maybe this is what will finally help our students to succeed. And I wrote down all your points, and I think I kind of went off of what some of them were. But if anybody has other particular questions on any concerns I had, I'd be more than happy to answer them. I'm thrilled with what we've come up with.
I have Senator Bonoff, Senator Cruz, and then Senator Nelson. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is late, and so I will be brief, but members know that I'm quite passionate about education, so it's hard to curtail my remarks, but I will do my best because my seatmate is watching me, ready to go home. No. So first of all, I would like to thank and acknowledge Senator Olson for the work that she has done, both as chair and in putting this bill together. I happen to be an admirer of Senator Olson and have watched the tenacity with which she has brought her commitment, particularly to literacy, but to all of education, in the 6 years that I have been in this body. I watched her and Kathy Saltzman take on the House for 2 years until the House did relent and put into law some of the best policy around literacy, you know, that I think probably any state has. So I think this bill does contain much needed reforms. I think putting in a program where we actually have all of our districts with an eye towards who's reading, who's not, and who's making growth is a quantum leap. I think that's very important. I think putting the teacher evaluation in the bill is important, although I think the Senate version was better than the House's. And so I can understand Senator Wolf's concern with the House language. I think one of the saving graces about what's in the Senate bill with regard to teacher evaluation is there is a provision that says a task force made up of teachers, administrators, parents will come together in the year following enactment to put together the real framework to implement teacher evaluation. I think what was missing was too much prescriptive direction to the districts, that if this thing's going to work, it's got to come from the bottom up. It's got to bubble up from the teachers in partnership with their administrators. QComp works because of that partnership in the districts. The teachers voted on it. They work as mentors for each other, and that's the spirit of any teacher evaluation proposal going forward. Three concerns I would have for the bill. One would be the House carried the day on this A through F grading system. Again, I think if we focus on the teacher evaluation, then we can hold our schools accountable, and we can hold them accountable in relationship to how our kids are doing. I think adding that A through F is a little bit like adding insult to injury, and I know that our districts find it that way. And so I would have preferred if we didn't accept that provision. The other thing is the qualified economic offer. Again, if we change this first in, last in, whatever, if we change that provision, it is late, members. If we change that provision and put a real strong teacher evaluation system in place, then don't mess with collective bargaining. That's just going to create antagonism and an environment of distrust. I think we have to walk very carefully and do these kinds of policy reforms in some way surgically, so that we make sure not to alienate our most prized resource, and that is our teachers. So getting some of that out of the bill, I think, will make it that much stronger. I'm hopeful there is a round two, because I think this bill is too good to just walk away from. The final thing that I am, again, concerned about, because it's missing, and that is the early childhood scholarships. I would hope that we do not leave on Monday without those early childhood scholarships. I know there are concerns by other members with regard to the implications of changing the special ed formula for this biennium, although it does revert back in the next biennium, and with regard to the integration. But I would really urge members to make sure you read the fine print, because Senator Olson did, number one, put the levy side back in of that integration, and then created a special account just for the cities of the first class so that they are made whole with regard to those funds. And so I think the the bigger picture is not about taking anything away from any district. The bigger picture is shifting our attention from a policy that doesn't focus on achievement to what is going to make the biggest difference to our children and their future, and that really is a focus on literacy. Nobody has mentioned that there is a provision in the bill that tries out vouchers for the first time that's being passed. And again, this is like a toe in the water. It's saying if you are the most at-risk kids and you're in a low-performing school in the cities of the first class, then you have the option to do that. And so that's an additional reform that's in the bill that I know is very controversial. But, you know, I think that all things ought to be on the table so that there really is equality for all kids, that every child has the same equal and outstanding opportunity for an excellent education. Lastly, just wanted to thank the members of the conference committee again for including me as an ex officio member and allowing my input to make a difference and help shape some of the things that I was concerned about with regard to this bill.
Senator Cruz.
Madam President, members. Wow, there's so many things to say about this bill. I guess I'd like to start by saying thank you to Senator Olson. It was absolutely a pleasure to serve with you on this committee and on the conference committee. It was absolutely amazing to see some of the accomplishments that we have obtained in this bill as far as reform goes, as far as funding goes. As we're looking at a $5 billion deficit, we not only find a way to fully fund education, but fund it to the tune of a $500 million more. And I think that's a very, very important point to make here, because a lot of folks are going to be saying there's cuts, there's cuts, there's cuts, there's cuts. Members, there is not cuts in funding to education. I cannot be more adamant about this. We are funding education above and beyond anything we have ever funded it before. It just looks a little different. What you're looking at is a bill that contains some true reforms, reforms that are going to help our children moving forward get a better education. Senator Olson, I really wish you would have talked a little bit more about your literacy piece here, because I think that's one of the shining jewels of this bill. A program that strictly focuses on getting children to read by third grade, something that will help them throughout the rest of their education career. This program not only helps those who achieve literacy by third grade, but it also helps fund students who are making progress towards that goal. So we're not saying if you're not there, you're left out in the cold. We're saying we just want to see some progress that direction. So I really appreciate that about this bill. You know, listening to Senator Stumpf, it brought to mind a couple of things here. You know, he mentioned having educators at the table. Madam President, members, educators were at the table. Education Minnesota and their lobby were in every single one of those committee meetings. They were there. Their voice was heard. They testified, I would say, on almost every bill. So their voice was heard. Their voice was heard at the expense of collecting dues at taxpayer dollars. We paid to have them there as taxpayers, because our school districts collect those dues. They were there. They had an input, but it was time for some real reform. And I really appreciated what Senator Stumpf said about negotiating with the House, because to be honest, you know, even with two of the same parties coming to the table, being both sides having Republican control, it was still a little difficult. People have great ideas, whether they're in the House or the Senate, and we had to find a way to meld those together. But let me tell you what was a little bit more difficult than working with the House. It was getting the governor to the table. Though we asked, we could not get input. So what we had to do in this bill, members, was we had to negotiate against ourselves for the governor. And let me tell you a little bit about the evidence of that in this bill. Okay, here are some of the things that we did to try and come the governor's direction, even though he wasn't at the table. Transition aid. This was a program that was strictly developed to help cities of the first class move through this transition period as we do some of the literacy aid, as we kind of draw away from the integration aid and the compensatory aid. That was a huge step in his direction that we're hoping will bring him to the table and get him to sign this bill. Special education funding. We reduced the cuts in special education. We tried to come his way on that as well. Cuts to charter school funding. Many of the members on our committee are big fans of charter schools and school choice, giving our parents choice in their child's education. And a lot of us felt that charter schools were a part of that. But we went the governor's direction on his cuts to charter schools. There's another step. Compensatory aid not being frozen. That was a big step coming in the governor's direction as well. Essentially, what we're doing with compensatory is we're just taking the top off of it. We're not getting rid of the funding that's there. So that's a huge thing to remember. And I would say that adding the $21 to the formula was also a huge, huge direction towards the governor and an incentive to getting him to sign this bill. You look at some of these programs like integration aid and compensatory aid, and it's really easy to see why we're having problems closing the achievement gap. By statute, these programs are I would say, ill-defined. It's not real clear where these dollars go. And there's huge dollars associated with this. When you look at integration aid is $120 million a biennium. But bigger than that is compensatory aid. Compensatory aid is right around $800 million a biennium. But we don't have the results to show for these dollars that we're spending. In our cities of the first class and other cities that struggle with the achievement gap, we haven't seen it close. But we keep spending more and more dollars every biennium on these programs. It's time to change, members. It's time to take a different direction. It's time to go a direction that has true reform, true accountability, which will yield true results. That's what this does. We got some great mandate relief in this bill. Mandate relief that's going to help our school districts manage their finances in a difficult economic time. We have some great mandate relief for our families. We have some great provisions. One of the things that I was particularly proud of was the college and schools and extending that to 9th and 10th graders who are able to take advantage of that. I don't understand why we would hold our students back. If they can perform at that level, then let's let them do it. Let's let them move on. Let's let them shine. So it's common sense reforms like this that I guess, you know, really have me hopeful that the governor's going to sign this. And I'm very proud of this bill. Though I'm not 100% happy with it, I'm proud of it. And I think that's a good measure. I guess not. Well, I'll close it up. I didn't mean to shake anybody out there. So, but I guess all I'm saying with that is I think that's the sign of a good compromise is when you're not 100% happy with it, but you're proud of it. When it comes to the end, you can put your name on it. That's a good sign.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Don't want to risk anyone falling asleep here, but I would like to give you just a couple comments about our conference committee, some of the comments we heard tonight, and then why I would encourage you to vote for this bill. I agree with Senator Bonhoff. She said that she liked the Senate bill better. So do I. I think most of us in the Senate did like our Senate education bill better, but the fact of the matter is we had to compromise, and we had to compromise with the House, and we did. Regarding teachers at the table, this may be the first time, there may be another time, but we had three teachers sitting at that conference table, Senator Wolf, Senator Olson, and myself. So the teachers were at the table there. And then I just wanted to mention one more thing about that conference committee. You know, we've talked a lot about waiting for the governor to weigh in. We've had our bills done for 5 weeks now, and we had wanted the governor to come and weigh in with us, or his commissioners, to talk about what could we put in these bills that he would be willing to sign. Well, I'd like to let you know that Commissioner Caselius did come to one conference committee meeting. We had many. I can't remember exactly how many, but she did come to one. But what you need to know is she specifically asked not to be called upon, not to talk, not to testify. I do not think that that is helping in any way in coming to a negotiation there. I want to just mention a couple of the comments that were heard here tonight talking about funding. The one thing I would like our members to remember is that this bill includes $465 million of additional money to the K-12 system. Part of that is an additional per pupil funding of $20 and $21. Now, I noticed that Senator Stump talked a lot about this 5% reduction, and I think it's important for people to realize he was talking about a 5% reduction to the Department of Education. Now, the department does many good things, members, but I will tell you, if we have a choice about where money should go, it need not go to a bureaucracy. It needs to go to the classroom where it can benefit students. So remember, money needs to go to where it can best benefit students. A couple other issues that were brought up had to do with staff development. And there was maybe some indication that there might be less money for schools to have staff development. Members, that is not the case. Not the case at all. The fact of the matter is that the education bill simply removes the mandate that districts must spend 2% on staff development. Districts can continue to make that choice. They can spend 10% of their budget on staff development. But we believe that districts are in the best position to make that decision. So when you hear about staff development, just remember it's now up to the districts rather than 201 legislators up here telling districts how to spend their money. Probably the most important piece of this bill has been mentioned before, and that is literacy aid. Members, we have 15,000 students, Minnesota students, every year who fail the third grade reading test. I'm a reading specialist, and you don't need a reading specialist to know that if you cannot read, you are going to have difficulty the rest of your life. 75% of our prison inmates have been troubled readers. Members, we need to make sure that our students are prepared and they are reading on grade level by the end of grade 3. There are two great provisions in this bill that do that. Funding to the Reading Corps has been tripled. The Reading Corps has great success on data-driven, research-based results. The funding that we have provided this year brings in a 3-to-1 match from the feds. That's pretty good, $3 for every dollar we put in. Historically, they've also brought a dollar-for-dollar match from the private sector. This is a good program, a good step toward making sure that kids can read. We've talked a lot about integration aid and changing that to literacy aid. Members, you know, that integration aid is so unfocused. The OLA specifically stated that there are fuzzy outcomes. fuzzy results, not even sure exactly what the purpose is. And, you know, Senator Tomasoni talked earlier tonight about how important it is that we have fair education funding. And I will tell you that that integration funding, besides not having really any focus, according to the OLA, is very unfair. The state cap is $129 per student. That's the state cap. But Minneapolis has $480 per student for integration aid, St. Paul, $445, and Duluth, $206. The interesting thing about that money is based upon the number of protected students in a district. However, the per pupil integration amount is taken times the entire district. And members, the important thing here is that money has been equalized so we can have more fairness and equity in the education funding. But more importantly, it's been focused. It's been focused on literacy. And members, it really doesn't matter what color someone's skin is. If they cannot read, they're going to have difficulty. Our number one job is to make sure that our kids are reading on grade level. So in addition to focusing funding where it needs to go in the classroom fairly and focused on what it needs to be, there's flexibility for the districts in determining who they may hire. They no longer have to hire certain categories of employees just because of a maintenance of effort agreement. We have removed that and allowed districts to hire exactly the teachers, the staff, that they think will best serve their students. There's equity in this bill. And finally, members, I would ask you to remember that the needs of the student come first. So our job is to make sure that as we look at our education bills, our education funding, and our education reforms, that we look at what's best for students. And as a teacher, let's make no mistake about it. Senator Stump mentioned that teachers were demoralized. Let's get it on the record. It's a fact. The quality of a teacher is the most important in-school element, in-school factor, regarding student achievement. Therefore, it is very critical that we have the very best teachers possible and that we pay them accordingly. So again, I'd ask for a green vote on this. It's best for kids. Thank you.
Senator DeCrave.
Thank you, Madam President. I want to start out by thanking Senator Olson for all of her work, all of those on the committee. We had some great interaction on this committee, bipartisan, and we had an opportunity to hear some of the greatest educators, I think, from around the nation. A lot of think tanks, a lot of people from other states that were coming in and telling us what their successes were. We were hearing from charter schools that would start in some of the poorest areas, where you would think that you would have real difficulty finding high achievement. And what I think we learned is we learned being poor doesn't mean you can't learn. You just have to find a way to help those students break out of that. One of the provisions in this bill that I want to just point out was actually brought forward from the House, and it was one of my House members, and it's the the part that gives some students who are from a very poor neighborhood and an underachieving neighborhood an opportunity to go to a private school. What this basically does is it takes a persistently poor performing school in a city of the first class, which basically includes Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and it allows them, if 4 years in a row, no, three school years, if more than 40% of the students' score does not meet the at-level standards in math, and more than 50% of the students demonstrate growth in reading or math, is not proficient in either low or medium growth or proficient in low growth. So what it really amounts to is I don't think that there's an awful lot of people that would argue that if you're trapped in a school that is very, very low performing, we have to do something to give these students an opportunity to get out. So what I like this portion of this bill. I hope the governor does. What we need to do is we need to look at more ways of giving children an opportunity to escape some of these schools that are very, very low performing.
Further discussion, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam President and members. I'd just like to be as brief as possible, but also express some of my serious concerns with this legislation. First, while I respect the work that the members of the committee did in the conference committee, I do think that there are way too many provisions in this bill that are still attacks on our teachers. It's clear that no one wants incompetent teachers in our classrooms, and I put at the top of that list, especially other teachers. But it's important, I think, that we have a locally developed quality education program for teachers in the state before we start to make very significant changes to continuing contracts, such as done in this bill. I had a bill on teacher evaluation that was modeled after the principal evaluation work that is done in this legislation. I do think that that principal evaluation legislation is good and a good provision in this bill. However, we weren't able to obtain a hearing on a teacher evaluation model that I believe would have gained much more consensus and had teachers actually supportive of that. And again, I just bring that up to say that before we start changing so significantly the rights of teachers to collectively bargain, it's important that we have a quality teacher evaluation program in place that teachers across the state can support, as well as our local school boards and school administrators. Like I said, something similar, something along the lines with the principal evaluation language that's contained in this bill. Second, I'd like to speak to the voucher language that is included in this legislation. I think it's really actually disturbing and troubling, and I would refute what my good friend Senator Bonhoff said, that vouchers are reform for two reasons that I'll just highlight. First, the outcomes are very unclear as to whether vouchers who go to students from poor backgrounds actually improve their test scores. We saw recent data from the state of Wisconsin that showed that voucher students are nowhere near their public school counterparts, even in those Milwaukee public schools that they left. So the outcomes are unclear. And second, the constitutionality is somewhat questionable or very questionable. I understand that the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Cleveland School Voucher Program, but our Minnesota state constitution speaks specifically to this in that, and I'll read you a part of the Minnesota Constitution. Article 13, Section 2 says, prohibition as to aiding sectarian school. In no case shall any public money or property be appropriated or used for the support of schools wherein the distinctive doctrines, creeds, or tenets of any particular Christian or other religious sect are promulgated or taught. Members, it was important enough for us to have in our Minnesota Constitution that we not spend state taxpayer dollars to go to private sectarian schools. I think it's really disturbing that we're now proposing as a Senate or as the legislature to send public taxpayer dollars to some of private schools that, I should also say, in the original House language, which is not adopted in the conference committee report, there was language that restricted somewhat what type of public, non-public schools could receive these voucher students. And that language, which prohibited the schools from discriminating against children with special needs. It ensured that they had anti-discrimination and harassment violence prevention policies. That language was removed or was never adopted in the conference committee report, making this all the more disturbing. So I'll wrap up my comments, but just say again that while I appreciate attempts at reform, instituting a private school voucher program is not reform that is good for the state of Minnesota, good for its taxpayers, and most importantly, good for our public school students or any students in Minnesota.
I have Senator Kreif, then Senator Hahn. Senator Kreif, and then I'll put Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam President. I just want to add one point to the point that Senator Sieben made about voucher money going toward a private school. I think the reality is there's already some money going, public money going to private schools. I think with busing, for instance, you know, many of our private school children are riding the public school buses. Secondly, I think the interpretation of the law would probably mean that public school money and public money shouldn't go toward the Christian part of the education. I think the general education that a student would receive, I don't think is a problem. But the specific part that of the religion portion of it, that I don't think should be public money at all. Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President and members. And I did want to comment a little bit about this particular provision in the bill that is being discussed that has to do with the vouchers. And some members may recall that I have been a fan or a proponent in some way for this idea. It is not a new idea. This has been around a long time, probably 50 years at least. The late Milton Friedman, the great Nobel-winning economist, was a very strong proponent of vouchers. And essentially what a voucher is a way to let people decide. It's a way to let families decide which schools their children should attend. And it's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a thing that many people of middle and higher incomes have in various ways the opportunity to do. They can move to a different place where they think the schools are better, or if they choose, they can pay the money to have their children go to a private school. They have options. They have choices. But for many lower income people, their choice is the local school, period. End of story. And what a voucher does is say, if a person of low income wants to, for whatever reason, whether it's education, whether it's curriculum, whether it's safety, whatever the reason might be, that they should have the opportunity to make the choice about which school is right for their children. And really, this is a question of who decides. Who gets to decide what schools my kids should attend? Should it be a legislature? Should it be a bureaucracy? Should it be the geography of some school district map? Or should it be the family, the parents, or the children? And I think it's important, and particularly important if we're talking about achievement, to make sure parents are fully engaged in the education of their kids. And one of the ways they can be engaged is by choosing and participating in the schools their children attend. And there's been a lot of debate about the voucher system in Milwaukee that's been in place about 20 years, I think. And people always say, oh, it's failing, but that's not the case. They have put limits on participation in that program in Milwaukee, and every year they struggle because people want that limit, that cap to be raised. So regardless of what people may think about the success of the academics of the program, and I think that the studies show that they have been successful, the fact is that parents choose those schools. And we all know that when you have parents involved in the education of their children, things go better, and education is facilitated by that act alone. I do want to comment a little bit about the constitutionality of this provision and to make the claim that vouchers is constitutionally impermissible is just plain wrong. It's not true. It's absolutely not true. We have for years had public dollars going to private schools in the form, as Senator Kreif has mentioned, transportation, also textbooks, special education, a number of things. I think the last time I looked at this a few years ago was something on the order of about $50 million a biennium of public money is currently being spent in some form in private schooling in Minnesota at the K-12 level. But in addition to that, we have a whole bunch of public money that is being used and in grants that is being taken by families and students to go to St. Thomas or Gustavus or St. John's, all religiously affiliated higher institutions. And somehow the Constitution is okay with that, but it isn't okay with the fact that that same exact style of choice can't exist in a K-12 system. And that's wrong. And I would just encourage members, as they look at the Constitution, to look at the date, the year, that that amendment was adopted into the Minnesota Constitution, because that's important. What we have in the Minnesota Constitution is what is called a Blaine Amendment. And you can look this up on the internet or in library or wherever you want, and there's a history to Blaine Amendments. James Blaine was a congressman from the state of Maine. He became prominent in the late 1800s. He ran for president at one point. But one of the things that he tried to get done was to put in place a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution to forbid what he called sectarian education. And this was at a time when there was a huge influx of immigration into this country of Eastern European people, many of whom were Roman Catholic. And at that time in the history of our country, this was largely a Protestant country. And so the public schools of that era largely reflected the Protestant culture. And at that time, Bibles were very commonly used in schools as part of the textbook, part of the curriculum. And there are differences between the Protestant Bible and the Catholic Bible. And so there were concerns that if the recent immigrants who happened to be Roman Catholic came into the schools, they would somehow become Catholicized rather than Protestantized in the use of the texts and the Bibles that were part of the curriculum. And so he wanted to get an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would forbid this from occurring. And it didn't happen. They tried. It was not successful. And one of the results of that, by the way, was the emergence and the growth of what became the Catholic parochial school system. But along the way, many states adopted into their state constitution the same prejudicial idea that we shouldn't allow money to be spent in a what was called sectarian school. And many states adopted them. Minnesota was one. So what we have in Minnesota's constitution is a vestige of prejudice against a particular religion that grew out of a particular point in our history as a country. And to turn to that and say, that is the principle that we're going to stand on to deny families the choice of which school their kids go to, I think is profoundly wrong. And in other states that have had these amendments that have been challenged in court, every single one of them has found to be unconstitutional. So I don't know that we need to fear having a voucher system come into Minnesota's education system, and if it leads to a challenge of that particular amendment, I would be surprised if it wasn't overturned. And I would look forward to that court battle, and I think would be successful for the people like me who believe that school choice is important. It is a key to bringing about greater achievement and greater success and efficiency in our school system. We want more parent engagement. We want parents to be involved with their kids. We want the school systems, whatever they may be, to be successful. And the idea that schools have to compete for students is a very good thing. And we've seen that in some of our public schools. And I can think of one in the district that I represent that has done a very good job of understanding the need to try to make sure that parents and families understand what they are doing. And they have, in a part of the metro area that has a flat or declining enrollment, they have done a good job of increasing enrollment by attracting students to their school. And they do that because they know it's important if they're going to sustain their programming that they do the jobs of attracting and retaining students. Charter schools do the same thing. That's one of the reasons why charter schools are good, is that they have to attract and retain students and families by choice. And when you have that dynamic in place, there are all kinds of incentives for schools to get better. And we ought to encourage that. We ought not be afraid of it. We ought not to prohibit it, but we ought to encourage it. I think if you look at what's in our Constitution about education, I think what we have is a constitutional mandate that says we have a job to do to make sure that every young person is educated. It is a commitment, a public commitment to education. It is not a commitment to defend a particular institution that we just happen to have in place as it is today. That institution, as we have it today, did not exist when the Minnesota Constitution was written. So our commitment to education in the Minnesota Constitution isn't to defend the public education structure as we have today, but it is a commitment to the idea of educating the next generation. And whether that happens in a home school or a private school or a charter school or an online school or a traditional public school, that really doesn't matter. Our commitment should be to make sure that every student has the opportunity to attend the school that is right for that child, and the person and the people who should decide that should be the families, should be the parents. That should be our commitment to education. And so I believe that this is a good bill. I was not a part of the conference committee, but I was proud to serve on the committee with Chair Olson and others. I think this is a bill that could be historic with a number of, I think, significant reforms, and this is one of them. And so I would urge members to support it.
Specifically to that point, Senator Latz, very specifically.
Madam President, Senator Hahn, I wasn't going to speak on this bill, but Senator Hahn raised a number of points that I would like to specifically address, in particular connection with the voucher program and the use of public funds to support or advance private religious education, which is essentially what this voucher program would do. This is bad policy on a number of fronts. One is that it would take public dollars away from the public schools and would deliver those dollars instead to private schools, schools which have or have not a religious component. But defunding the public schools is not a way to improve public education. Secondly, Senator Hahn suggests that it may be constitutional to do this, as did Senator DeCryf. And I would challenge whether or not it would be constitutional to do this, and we don't need to get into a discussion of Lemon versus Kurtzman and the U.S. Supreme Court's guidance on this or how Minnesota's constitutional provision might be interpreted. But let's say as a matter of policy that money is fungible. So whether it's technically going toward the specific religion class in a school or the hours in a day in which chapel is the part of the curriculum. As a matter of policy, I'd submit to you that it is bad policy for public dollars, which taxpayers have no choice about where they're spent once the legislature appropriates them. We've had this discussion in recent days on other topics. It's bad policy for us to appropriate public tax dollars to a school which can then use freed up dollars to advance its religious purpose. Dollars are fungible. They can flow from account to account or free up dollars to be used for those purposes. Now, it sounded to me like Senator Hahn was saying that his method of constitutional interpretation is a flexible one that ought to be updated to modern standards to reflect the current educational system, not the one that was in effect at the time of the writing of the Constitution. And in most contexts, I would support that approach to constitutional interpretation, Senator Hahn and members. But Senator Hahn suggests that this is about school choice, that we need this voucher program to promote school choice. Well, we already have school choice in Minnesota, constitutional school choice, without running afoul of religion clauses anywhere. We have charter schools. We have open enrollment. This is school choice. So no public school student is being denied a public education or an education at all. In fact, they're not being denied a private school education if they choose to do that. All I'm suggesting is that they should use their own private money to pay for their private education, religious or otherwise. And we had this discussion, this debate on this floor, in just the opposite context in the abortion debate, where we were told we shouldn't have to pay for abortions. It's not denying a poor woman the choice to have an abortion. They just have to use their own money. Well, let's be consistent in our application of that principle. We don't need to pay for students to go to private religious schools to get their education. They can use their own money. They still have their full choice to do so if they wish, without running afoul of the Constitution or the principles recommended by the Constitution.
Senator Hahn to that?
Thank you, Mr. President, and thanks to Senator Latz for his willingness to participate. I think it's an important discussion to have. Senator Latz talked about what this represents as defunding public schools, and it isn't. It's about making sure that parents have the ability to choose the schools for their children. And Senator Latz mentioned a number of things that Minnesota has, and we do have, compared to some other states, a large number of choices. And I would just remind members that every one of those choice options that Senator Latz talked about, open enrollment, charter schools, every single one was opposed by the education status quo, the unions and others, when they were first introduced. Everyone was opposed and fought and said would become the death and demise of education and public schooling in this state. Everyone was opposed, but yet we did them. Things didn't end, the world didn't end. In fact, things may have gotten better, as some of us believe. But the point is that school choice, every step of the way, has been resisted by the defenders of the status quo. And the fact is that the school system that we had in this state when we became a state is nothing at all like the school system that we have today. And so my point about what the Constitution means, it doesn't mean we have to do everything we can to defend and protect the current institution that we have in front of us today and try to make sure that nothing ever changes in that institution. That is not what our Constitution means. It is a commitment to education. And I would suggest that is true, and I would invite members again. I know earlier Senator Bach had taken us on a little history lesson down history lane, I guess, and I'd like to continue that maybe in a little different direction, but I would recall members to review the Northwest Ordinance, which is found in the front of the legislative manual. We've got a copy of the state constitution and the U.S. Constitution, and there's something called the Northwest Ordinance. And this is interesting, I think, to this debate, because the Northwest Ordinance was written in 1787, which is the same year that the delegates from the Continental Congress at the federal level sent delegates to Philadelphia to write the U.S. Constitution. So the same people that wrote and adopted the U.S. Constitution wrote and adopted the Northwest Ordinance, 1787. And that applied to a tract of land, territories that were ceded to the federal government under the Articles of Confederation at that time that were claimed by various states. And it was the territory, the land north and west of the Ohio River. And this was land that later became the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and part of Minnesota. And this was a unique time in American history and world history. This had never happened where there had been new states created that had an opportunity to join a republic of confederated states, and they wanted to draft a document that would say, how do we do this? And when people live in those territories, what do they need to do, and how do they... They tried to create some structure for them to live together. And in that relatively brief document, Article 3, there is one line that pertains to education, and this is unique because it is a statement by our founders of their understanding of the purpose and function of education. And the reason that's unique is because they are completely silent in the U.S. Constitution about education. Education is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, even though today we have to spend a great deal of money at the federal level for something that isn't even mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. And it's not because the founders forgot about it or didn't realize how important education was or were thinking of something else. They knew about it a great deal, and they were very educated men and women. And they did talk about education in that Northwest Ordinance, and they wrote a statement about it, and I want to quote it to you because it pertains to this. And what they said is, and it is a direct quote, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary for good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged." That was the statement that the founders of this country wrote in a document in 1787, the Northwest Ordinance, that pertained to the governance of the territories, part of which became the state of Minnesota. That was their understanding of schools and education. They said you had to have three things that were necessary: religion, morality, and knowledge. Not just nice, not just good, but necessary. For what? For good government and happiness, and that sort of philosophical idea of being who we were created to be. That those things were necessary. And how do you get them? They said schools and education. And so I think if you combine that thought with the fact that we have in our Constitution a commitment to education, and then we turn around and say, oh, by the way, when we passed a biased, anti-religious reaction to immigration in the 1870s that was directed at Catholics, and we're going to stand on that Blaine Amendment as our reason why we're not going to allow people to make choice about schools, I would say no. Return to what the founders thought. Return to the idea that ordinary people, men and women, can and should make decisions about schools for their kids. And I think we'd all be better for it. Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm waiting for the transition. Thank you.
You're pretty quick.
Madam President and members, I think it's late. We're discussing the education of our children at 2:35 in the morning, and that's very unfortunate, I think. I think we should have done this early in the morning so that we get the public to hear this. I wish this would have been the first item in the agenda, because I believe that we're saying here right now that this is the most important thing that we do here. I wanted to just talk about very briefly about some points that were made earlier by members of the committee who conferenced this bill. And they talk about how brilliant and how wonderful this work that was put into this bill is, and how important it is for the future of the education of our children. And I have four things that I want to explain. The first one is the budget. The cost of education goes up every year, members, considerably. There are several factors that contribute to that that are out of our control, completely out of our control. They have nothing to do with innovation, intent, whether we want to pay teachers more or less, or have technology. None of that is related to the cost of education. The cost of education is related to healthcare, and you know that very well. Special education, the cost of maintaining our buildings and services, food, and transportation. Those costs are out of our control, and they go up every year significantly. We did nothing about that. In fact, for about 12 years now, we've done nothing about helping our school districts with the cost of education. As a result of it, we have a huge deficit in education, and we're not paying for it. So the fact that we put $20 per student into the formula, Senator Cruz, means nothing. Means nothing. It's a cut to education. So let me just explain that. The second part, members, that we talk about that we did here. So special education is a huge portion of what we have to pay for in education. And guess what we did, members? Now, these are the numbers that are in these tables. I'm not, you know, trying to argue with the members who said that we did something great here. Special education funding increases were cut by from 4.6% to 2% per year. That's a cut of 2.6% on special education. Then we went really into something even more problematic for certain districts that have high concentration of poverty, where we have significant achievement gaps. So those are the cities of the first class. We have a problem with the cities of the first class this year. You know, we cut LGA, which is really punishing the cities for having this high concentration of people who are expensive to educate. So we delinked the formulas that help those districts pay for the education of the lowest income children in the state of Minnesota. They are predominantly children of color and American Indian children, members. We've asked the question several times about why is that we cut the Human Rights Department by 67% versus 15% in other areas? Why is that we deleted all of the Indian child welfare programs from DHS? Here, members, we are cutting funding for districts that have high concentration of children that live in poverty. And these children are children of color. That's what we did. By delinking the formula, these districts will no longer have the funding that they used to have to address these fast-growing populations, this fast concentration. Then, and we also cut sparsity and transportation aid, which is very key to low-income communities in rural Minnesota. This is important. And these formulas, we always work in the Senate together to make sure that we take care of our kids in urban communities, in rural communities. I never understood sparsity until I went up north with the committee 3 years ago and really understood what it meant to have money for transporting a kid that was in kindergarten, 45 minutes of traveling, maybe more, to go to a school. There's nothing we can do about this. Sparsity is clear, it's real in greater Minnesota. We're not paying for it anymore. Now, this, to me, is the most important. This is the part that our chair and the majority members have described as one of the most innovative pieces of legislation that is being introduced in education right now, which is the Literacy Incentive Aid. Let me tell you, members, what the Literacy Incentive Aid actually is. It's in one line, and you really have to read this. It's in page 70 is section 51. It's only one sentence. The innovative policy that we put in place is one sentence, and let me read it to you. A school's proficiency allowance is equal to the percentage of students in each building that meet or exceed proficiency on the third grade reading Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. That's it. That's the innovative piece of policy that is being introduced here. So let me translate that to you. What that means is that we're going to give more money to those districts that have kids reading well in third grade. Never mind if if you're trying to teach kids to read in kindergarten and they make progress in second grade. We have none of that, which is truly the really literacy initiative that is being promoted nationally. You assess your kids early. You have a program in place to measure growth, and you fund that. That's not what this is. This is in third grade, you assess a kid, and if they're doing well, you give them money. Well, guess what? The districts who are doing well are going to get more money. The districts who have kids that are reading at proficiency levels, they are going to do great. They're going to get more money now so that they can read better. So kids that are now reading Harry Potter at second grade, now they can read Harry Potter in Chinese, I believe. That's what we're trying to fund here. That's the innovative policy that we're introducing here. I'm just going to stop here because I could go on and I could talk more about the teacher evaluation, which I so look forward to have a conversation with all of you members to really talk about teacher evaluation. We didn't have that opportunity. Being a parent of a 17-year-old, that I work so hard so that Tomas has this proficiency level. And he's not an at-risk kid. He doesn't come from an at-risk family. But my Tomas is not doing as well as he should. And his teachers are going to be penalized under this policy because he's not doing well. And a lot of his friends who are 17-year-olds who are only interested in girls right now and not in academic performance and are not doing well in school, guess what? based on this teacher evaluation, their teachers are going to be punished because these 17-year-old kids are just interested in girls right now. That's not fair. That's not fair to teachers. So I wanted to talk about evaluation. I believe that evaluation is key to education. I am still very interested in doing that, but I think we need to talk about growth and not proficiency in all of these measures. And I look forward to that opportunity. I know this is not the end. I know it's the beginning, but I wanted to really express my serious concerns about most of the policies that are included in this bill. Thank you, members.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam President. I just want to respond to the hour is late, and I don't think we should be belaboring things. I think everybody knows what they're going to do in terms of voting on this bill, and I know everybody values education and understands the complexity of dealing with the challenges before us. But I do need to clarify Senator Torres Ray's discussion of the literacy incentive aid. Purposefully, it is not totally based on proficiency. It's the way in which it's calculated, all the data has already been collected on state assessments because we have both a proficiency exam and we have growth. Both of those elements are part of the formula for distributing that aid. Part of it is on proficiency, a 3-year rolling average, so it one blip is not going to affect it all by itself. But growth is also honored and recognized for those that may be far behind but are working hard to change that. And when that aid comes to the to the school district, there are no strings attached to it. They can use it however they wish. If they want to reinvest it in efforts that are going to help them improve the proficiency of reading so they can, in fact, gain more money, that would be a sign that this is working as an incentive to improve the reading growth and proficiency. I think we recognize that. We've recognized it in how we've changed the law and the assessments and worked hard. I know our commissioner worked very hard with the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, and the No Child Left Behind restrictions on growth to get a recognition of the growth factor that can be, in fact, in assessing growth, that this can be recognized as well. So that is, it's not an intent to just recognize proficiency alone. We want to do it, and the work that Kathy Saltzman and I have done along the way was essentially focused on, for several years now, has been essentially focused on getting at the heart of why is it that we are not making progress in it, and the discovery was that our teachers were not being prepared with all of the tools that they needed for instructing in reading. It's some old, long-standing philosophical differences on how children learn to read. And that needs to change. We've been trying to crack that nut, and I think we're making progress. And I think more and more people, whether it's the private sector as well as our public sector, are recognizing that this cannot be allowed to continue. I'm delighted with the fact that Target has invested a substantial sum in Minneapolis schools and are putting Reading Corps members, two in every elementary building, because they have they are trained with those tools for learning reading instruction. And in fact, many of the teachers say, why didn't we learn this? That's the key. Teachers are the key, and we want them to be successful and effective, because who doesn't? I've been a teacher. It's very rewarding. The intrinsic values in teaching are really more important than the extrinsic, the money and the other kinds of things. When you know that you've achieved something and succeed, that means a lot to good teachers. And so I hope that we can continue down this path. This is a very small step in testing whether this kind of funding stream can in fact encourage and not discourage. It's not meant to take anything away. It's meant to be an encouragement and incentive so that schools can turn around and use that and work for more the next year. And I hope we can, if this proves to work, we need to add more resources to it to encourage others to faster achievement of that goal. I just want to say I appreciate all of the dialogue that we've had around this. It is late, and I hope that we can wind this up, but I have it's been an honor for me to be able to serve as chair of the Education Committee. I value and respect every single member of that committee. They've worked hard, they've been engaged, and we know that there are great challenges ahead. There are different perspectives and different views, and we've tried to open the door to consideration of a variety of things because we do need change. It concerns me and bothers me that we're going down a path with all the competition for state resources that may really harm education in the future. And many who have worked with it closely feel that we're on a path that's unsustainable. We've got to be finding ways that will improve our results with the investment that we make, and that doesn't just drive additional costs and reduce the productivity that we need to achieve. So I thank you, everyone, not only every committee member as well as those who served on the conference committee, and I would appreciate very much if you could find it to support the bill. I understand that there are concerns that individuals have, and I will not hold that against you, whatever decision you make.
Well, I have several people on the list, and I want to give them the opportunity to understand that Senator Olson's done her wrap-up. So we have been trying to respect the author's wrap-up. Senator Olson renews her motion that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report on House File 934 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion does prevail. Secretary will give House File 934, its third reading.
House File Number 934, Bill for an Act Relating to Education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 934.
Nobody voted.
All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will skedaddle up here. We'll close the roll. There being 37 ayes and 26 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on messages from the House, the secretary will read the messages.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce that the House has adopted a recommendation report of the Conference Committee on Senate File Number 958 and repassed said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. Senate File 958, a bill for an act relating to public safety. Senate File 958 is herewith returned to the Senate. Also, same message for Senate File 887 and repass said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. Senate File Number 887, a bill for an act related to economic development. Senate File Number 887 is herewith returned to the Senate. Same message for Senate File Number 1047 and repass said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. Senate File 1047, a bill for an act relating to state government operations. Senate File 1047 is herewith returned to the Senate. Same message on Senate File Number 760, repass said bill in accordance with the report of the committee so adopted. Senate File 760, a bill for an act relating to state government. Senate File 760 is herewith returned to the Senate. All messages by Alban A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There's no Senate action necessary on those messages. Remaining under motions and resolutions, we will go to Senate File 509, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee report on Senate File Number 509 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee.
To that motion, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, Senate File 509 is the bill that's described as the 21st Century Voting Act, otherwise known as the Voter Identification Bill. This bill, as many of you know from the past discussions that we've had on the Senate floor, is the preeminent issue is requiring a photo identification in order to cast a ballot in the state of Minnesota, designed to modify, modernize, and bring greater security to our voting process. The bill has five sections to it. The first one is on voter registration, photo ID, and provisional balloting. The second one is on election administration. The third section is electronic rosters. These are voluntary involvement by political subdivisions. And the fourth is on recounts. And I might make a comment, not right now, on recounts. The recounts here are simply recognizing and codifying in our state statute what our Secretary of State has already done by rule. There's no change in what we're doing. We're just simply recognizing it in statute. The fifth area is just a new title that I already mentioned, 21st Century Voting Act, a severability clause, and, of course, the appropriations. The appropriations, while we're on that subject, is getting smaller and smaller every time I talk about this bill. We started at about $65 million, and we're now reduced down to $4.9 million. $2.45 million comes out of the HAVA account, Help America Vote account, and the remainder of 2.4 or 2.45 comes out of the general fund. The two main fiscal changes in the Senate bill, we have an education campaign now created by the Department of Administration, and DPS, Department of Public Safety, card costs are now paid for with general fund rather than any fee increases that we had originally proposed. The bills that were introduced into the House and Senate in the final version were almost relatively the same, but as they went through both chambers, they had some slight variations and differences. They are not that many. Most of them are technical in nature, but let me just review those very quickly. Article 1, we did recognize what the governor has been requesting all session, and that's to recognize quarterly reporting for our campaign reports, not only during an election year, but in an off year. The only difference is that the quarterly report would start when the first $5,000 of aggregate revenue that you generate in a campaign would be triggering the first report. If you don't raise $5,000, then the quarterly report would not be required. Section 2, language allowing the release of data on applications for voter ID cards to courts or government entities is removed. Section 7, application for voter ID cards requires now at least four digits of the Social Security number, or unless you have certification that the applicant has not been assigned a Social Security number. There are people that don't have those. Section 12, an individual that is eligible to apply for status as a permanent absentee voter, that's someone that might be chronically ill, permanently residing in a nursing home, someone that cannot adequately or quickly move about, must be permitted to submit a photograph for use. That means we don't have to bring the individual to the voter or the driver license registration center. A simple photograph can be snapped of that individual wherever they are, and it can be included and sent to the Secretary of State. Section 19, the process has changed for election day registration documentation, and that identity and residence of a person who resides in a residential facility, a driver's license or ID card that includes a photo, can be used along with a certification of residency in a facility by the administrator of that facility. One could also use an older driver's license. We're just identifying who the individual is, and the address or the precinct of where that person lives would be verified by the administrator of the facility. Section 20 of Article 1, this limits the departmental reimbursement from the state subsidized voter ID card account to be limited to $9.85 per issued card. On June 31st of each odd-numbered year, any balance in the account would be transferred to the general fund. The process has changed to satisfy photo ID requirements for voting for a person who resides in a residential facility. And, of course, you can use a driver's license, an ID card that includes a photo. That, too, can be used along with a certification of residency by the facility administrator. We did make a little reference. There's always been a confusion in election law on whether or not an individual working only as an election judge.
Madam President.
For what purpose do you rise, Senator Higgins?
Madam President, I'm wondering whether Senator Limerick could just tell us the differences between what
Senator
left
Higgins,
here and what came back rather than a whole...
That's not a point that you can interrupt a speaker for.
Oh, how interesting.
Well, Senator Higgins, if you'd like to, I could show you exactly where it is because it was pointed out to me by one of your members. And it's generally to actually interrupt a speaker, it needs to be a point of order, among other things. But to tell him how to conduct his explanation of his bill is not something I think that would be considered appropriate to interrupt him for. Senator Limmer.
Madam President, thank you. Senator Higgins, I am going through just the differences right now. And I've got about 10 more to go. So if you'll allow me to continue, I'll go through those differences and then we can have at it. As I was saying, there's been a difference or an issue about whether or not an individual working as an election judge in a school is considered an employee of the school district. And we're claiming it once and for all, an individual working only as an election judge is not a school district employee. We also added references to challenged voters who have not proven eligibility to vote and who is unable to overcome the challenge. They would also be allowed to cast a provisional ballot. We're trying to make it available for anyone and everyone to make sure that when they do go to a voting booth, they will cast some form of ballot, either a real or a regular ballot or a provisional one. And I might add, 44 states have provisional ballot procedures. So really, Minnesota not having it does restrict people, because if there's a question of their registration, if there's a question of their qualifications of a voter, they get turned away now in Minnesota. Instead of voter presenting evidence of eligibility to vote, it's up to the auditor or the clerk to conclude whether the individual is eligible to vote based on available records presented by the voter. Article 2, throughout, a change is made to refer to individuals reported rather than to use the word believed to be ineligible. It's just a syntax correction. Requires residential housing lists from post-secondary institutions. This is regarding students. Any student within a 10-mile radius of a campus, there would be a list required to be at the voting precinct booths to verify their addresses. Quite often, students don't have a current updated driver's license from that specific area. They can use a driver's license or any other form of government photo ID from any state. And yet, at the same time, just to verify that we know who they are, but now we want to make sure that they are in the right precinct for voting. Secretary of State is required to provide some reports to amend matters in any current rules as necessary to implement this act. Article 3, this is one of the larger areas of the bill, changes. We in the Senate provided what we called an online computer line that was going to report election results directly to the Secretary of State. We modified that and accepted House language, which was what we would call an offline system. At least two laptops would be in every precinct. If they chose to go electronically, they can still go the paper route that many of your jurisdictions do. If they do go electronically, it would be at their own expense. However, the offline system works this way. You have one computer that's recording who comes in and votes, who registers, and yet at the same time, after they go through the voting process, then it's tabulated on the other end, so there is a direct comparison of when a vote is, or when a voter comes in, casts a ballot, and then when the ballot is fully registered, it would be a direct accounting to accounting. The thing that saves the money in this regard is that instead of reporting that precinct's results to the Secretary of State, it's reported to the county. And then the county reports it to the Secretary of State, and instead of having something like 4,000 precincts report to the Secretary of State, they only have 87 reports, and it cuts down our expense quite a bit on this. Matter of fact, the total cost, I believe, was close to $4.8 million for the entire bill, a considerable difference from the nearly $63 to $65 million of when we started. There is a task force to be formed by the legislature to bring in a number of people that are following all these elections. Practitioners in the area from school board elections, county, municipal, all of the entities that would be comprised of our election system would be included in this task force, as well as legislative members. And that's to iron out any other difficulties that may occur or any opportunities that may use to enhance any of these. No changes in any of the articles in Article 4. And Article 5 is just a little add-on. It entitled the act and added a severability clause and, of course, the appropriations I've already talked about. I'll stand for questions, Madam President.
Discussion on Senate File 509, actually to the Conference Committee Report. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam President and members. I'd urge members to vote against this bill, although I don't want to get into the details too much of what we already debated when the bill left the Senate floor. I'll just reiterate why I encourage members to vote against this. First, unlike other election provisions that have had major bipartisan support, there was no effort on the attempt of the majority party to bring the minority into these discussions at an early point to try to make this a truly bipartisan effort, which, like former Governor Carlson and former Governor Pawlenty and now Governor Dayton have said, is all important for when we make substantial changes to our election process, that it should be done in a bipartisan manner, and this certainly was not. Second key point on the overall bill is that I don't believe, and others would agree, that this bill does not make our election process more secure. It does nothing to address the relatively minor but still problem of felons who vote. And in fact, it will actually cause voter suppression and decrease turnout in a state like ours, which has among the highest voter turnouts across the country. Now, some of the specific provisions that came back from the conference committee report that in reviewing seemed to be somewhat troubling. First is that there was this provision added from the House that allows a voter to submit a photograph via mail. And I guess I'd ask Senator Limmer if he would yield. Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Senator Limmer will yield. Senator Sieben.
Senator Limmer, in the conference committee, did you have specific sign-off from the Department of Public Safety that that this photo image requirement or this photo image option is workable and meets standardized requirements? So that did the Department of Public Safety specifically testify to the fact that mailing in a snapshot, as you described, is would be permitted and the department would be able to handle that?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Sieben, you raised a number of questions. I'll try and address your last one first. There was discussion with DPS. However, I don't believe it was testimony in a formal way at the conference committee. I want to make sure you realize that we are using existing statute to justify the use of a photograph in this way. It's done for passports, by the way, and it's recognized that way, but we're also limiting this to people that have permanent illness or disability. It's state statute 203B.04, subdivision 5. And it's in reference to permanent illness or disability. Any eligible voter who reasonably expects to be permanently unable to go to the polling place on election day because of illness or disability may apply to a county auditor or municipal clerk under this section to automatically receive an absentee ballot application, and they can conduct their election by mail. Now, that's restricted to people that are permanently disabled, perhaps living in a nursing home, that type of setting. And using the authority that we use for passport photographs, an individual could take a photograph. Instead of bringing that individual out into the environment, which they may be, because of their frailty, may be harmed, the camera can be brought to them and be allowed to be used and registered with either the municipal clerk or the county auditor, and eventually getting a voter identification card free of charge. The other elements that you brought up was the questionable bipartisan nature that you're trying to characterize the process. You may recall in the elections committee that we did accept DFL amendments onto this bill in policy. We accepted Senator Weiger's amendment on the floor when we discussed this. We had close to six committee hearings of bipartisan participation in the process of making this bill into what it is today. The bipartisan nature certainly was offered to the minority party, and to a limited degree, they did affect the quality of this bill. You made reference of the non-security, and it doesn't stop felons from voting. I would like to turn you to page 31 of the bill, section 11, found there on page 31, line 23, where we create a challenged eligibility list. And if I could just read the first line in it, the Secretary of State shall maintain an electronic database of individuals not registered and who are reported to be ineligible to vote under already existing law, section 201.014. Let me tell you what 201.014, eligibility to vote statute already passed into law, is. It means, it talks about eligibility to vote and those who are not eligible to vote. The following individuals are not eligible to vote. This is going to be on a list that will be available for election judges to look at. Something that we don't really have right now. any individual, A, convicted of treason or any felony whose civil rights have not been restored, B, under a guardianship in which the court order revokes the ward's right to vote, or C, found by a court of law to be legally incompetent. That's existing state law that we are recognizing and requiring the Secretary of State to maintain an electronic database of these individuals. This would assure that felons will not vote.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Limmer, thanks for that extensive answer to my one question, which was, did the Department of Public Safety approve this provision where you could essentially perpetuate voter impersonation by sending in a photo or an image that matches the demographics in which you submit it, but there's no way for the Department of Public Safety to verify that that photo you're sending in is indeed who you say you are? And so I would just like to reiterate or to express to members concerns that the department, when asked by members if they approved this section of the legislation or thought that this would be doable, made it clear that they had not approved this and did have significant concerns about their ability to verify the identity of the person and also their ability to meet standardization requirements for using the photo for a duplicate card or when there's a change of residence in case a card is lost. Moving on to other sections of the bill that I think are troubling, the delay of the primary canvassing dates were changed. Senator Rest and I believe Senator Gerlach worked on this on previous legislative sessions to ensure that our military and overseas voters would have time to submit absentee ballots and would be their votes essentially would be counted. For the new members, if just to give you a short bit of history, there was a bipartisan effort in the 2010 session to move the state primary to ensure that the state would not only comply with the Federal MOVE Act, but also essentially to make sure that military voters, those people who are serving our country, would have time to submit their absentee ballots between the date of the primary election and the general election. And moving the canvassing dates as this does will jeopardize the ability of military and overseas voters to participate in Minnesota elections. In another section of the bill, I find it particularly interesting or questionable why the Secretary of State's office is specifically prohibited from being able to be mentioned when there's when voters are directed to check for the status of their provisional ballots. So if a voter wants to check to see if their provisional ballot was counted, and the Secretary of State under this legislation would be specifically directed or excluded from being able to be mentioned, which begs the question of then where will Minnesota voters be directed to check the status of their provisional ballot to ensure that if they did later submit the proper identification that's needed to have their provisional ballot counted, if they're not going to check the status with the Secretary of State's office, to whom are they going to turn to check this? Finally, I think, and if I'm not mistaken, that HAVA funding, now there's $2.4 million that's coming from the general fund for enactment of this bill instead of coming from the HAVA account. I believe that that is correct. And I would just say, members, in wrapping up here, that spending $2.4 million in an effort that will essentially disenfranchise potentially thousands of seniors from being able to vote seems to be not the wisest use of money. I'd encourage members to reject this bill. And Senator Bonoff spoke to this when the bill left the Senate. We should work in a bipartisan manner. It doesn't just mean that there are committee hearings where DFL members try to amend your bill, Senator Lemmer, but I think the true model of what has worked in previous sessions needs to happen if we're going to see significant update to our election system, which is we need all stakeholders involved, the majority and minority parties, local election officials, the Secretary of State's office, and others to really move forward and have discussions around what we can do to update Minnesota's election systems so that all Minnesotans have confidence in the election system, but at the same time, we're not disenfranchising potentially thousands of voters. So again, I'd encourage members to vote no on this conference committee report.
Discussion regarding the motion to adopt. Senator Lemmer, you care to do final review?
Thank you, Madam President. I really can't continue without making some comments about Senator Sieben's questions and suspicions about this bill. Senator Sieben, you talked about how would we verify a photograph in the event of a shut-in individual that I had described. The verification is created by the facility administrator, and they would be signing on a form that would be prescribed by the Secretary of State. If they don't know who that individual is, I don't know who will. Number two, military voting. We do nothing in this bill to alter existing military voting in our state statute. Not a word. Who would check to see how the provisional ballot, if it were counted or not? That is a duty prescribed in the proposal, either the city clerk in the local city jurisdiction or the county auditor where that provisional ballot is collected. As for HAVA funding, it is true we're using $2.45 million of HAVA funds, and the other $2.45 roughly is used from the general fund. I think that covers, I think, all of the comments that you may have raised. Is there any other questions?
Seeing no further discussion, Senator Lemmer renews his motion. Well, Senator Lemmer, we have to adopt the conference committee report, and then we go to third reading.
Yes.
Senator Lemmer renews his motion that the foregoing recommendations and conference committee reports on Senate File 509 be now adopted and that the bill be repassed as amended by the conference committee. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion does prevail. Secretary will give Senate File 509 is third reading.
Senate File Number 509, a bill for an act relating to elections, third reading.
Final discussion on Senate File 509. Seeing none, the Secretary.
Madam President.
You are looking for. All right, Senator Lemmer.
With all the discussion on all the other bills, I thought that I could at least get 4 hours out of the crowd tonight. But I'm not going to push my luck because even my majority votes may depart. I want to thank you all for following along with this bill. Although this issue was brief tonight, I know you've been following it. And this certainly would usher in the voting process into the 21st century in Minnesota. Senator Ortman has simply told me, just request him to vote yes and be quiet. And I think I'm going to end it that way. And I certainly would appreciate all of you recognizing that we can do our voting process a lot easier, simpler, faster, and maybe even cheaper by voting for this bill. Thank you.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 509. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 37 ayes and 25 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving on to the 13th order of business, announcements of Senate interest. Excuses for the day. Without objection, the following members will be excused. Senator Scheid all day. Senator Reinhart from 150 to 155. Senator Kubley from 650 to 915. Senator Dibble from 645 to 830. Senator Kubley from 12 midnight to the end of session. Senator Sieben from 815 to 1130 p.m. Senator Rest from 205 a.m. till the end. Senator Berglund from 305 till the end of session. Senator Goodwin from 205 a.m. till the end of session. And Senator Stump from 3 p.m. to 415 p.m. Without objection, those members will be excused. There's a correction for Senator Sieben. It will be Senator Sieben will be excused from 8:15 to 9 o'clock p.m. I read that one. Further announcements of Senate interest. Senator Koch.
Hey, members. After 20 hours of good debate and one just near miss accident, Senator Stumpf, you'll know that Senator Ron Latz was able to get his card to Senator Stumpf almost immediately upon the mishap. He'll be well represented in his case against the Senate. Members, I would move that we do now adjourn to Thursday, May 19th at 12 noon. 12 noon.
Senator Koch moves that we adjourn until Thursday, May 19th. We're doing it again. Senator Koch moves we adjourn until Thursday, May 19th at noon. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.